Welcome to Measure the Pattern, a show that takes a hard look at the Holy Temple through scriptural eyes and shows us our responsibilities in Torah to learn of the temple and thereby learn of ourselves. We have a call-in line at 503-967-3001. Please call with your questions. Also, if you'd like to come to the chat room on HebrewNationOnline.com, please feel free.
All right, we're back for another 2 hours, and it's going to be more of Kli HaMikdash with Rambam this week. We're going to go from Halakha 7 in Chapter 4 until we reach the end of the 2 hours, and I know that Joe has spent some time getting ready for it, and Joe has very little time to spend getting ready for anything, so I'm thrilled that he's willing to do this for us. Joe, you there?
Right here, Gene.
Fantastic. I don't know what you want to tell everybody about, but I'm ready to go when you are.
All right. Well, first thing, it's better if people could read with us.
Yes, a good idea.
And also, here's a great advantage, is the link that we'll take you to is a secure link. You don't have to worry about viruses or anything along those lines, but it gives you one of the major sources, not only on the temple, but you could take virtually any topic that deals with Torah, such as the Passover, such as kosher foods, whatever. And a major work was done hundreds of years ago by Moses Maimonides, or the Rambam, known as the Mishneh Torah. Now, the Mishneh Torah is where Rambam went into all of the Mishnah, the Tosafta, the Talmud Bavli, the Talmud Yerushalmi, and he found all the various halakot, or the how you keep the commandments according to the law that was set by the Sanhedrin. And he organized these into topics. And so he has a whole section that deals with the temple, which is called Sefer Avodah. And Sefer Avodah is divided into separate topics. And we're on his second book within Sefer Avodah, which is Hilkot Kli HaMikdash, or the vessels of the temple and their service. And so what you do is you go to Chabad, that's spelled chabad.org. When you get to the site, there's going to be a search engine. So type in Mishneh Torah, M-I-S-H-N-E-H. Let me spell that again. M-I-S-H-N-E-H. Torah, Mishneh Torah, and then you click on, it'll give you a choice of Hebrew or English. Click on the English and then scroll down in the list of books to Sefer Avodah, and the second book will be Hilkot Kli HaMikdash. Okay? So first, join with us and read right along with us, and also have this as a resource. Secondly, Gene, I made a gallery, a photo gallery, to accompany this this broadcast, and it's on the JerusalemTempleStudy.com website, which is one of my websites, and you go to the All Teachings button. Now, if you're not a member, we have different membership levels from free up to through bronze, silver, and gold, but this is in the free member site. So if you aren't a member, you can become a member. Won't cost you anything. And go to the All Teachings menu bar, drop it down, and it will say photo galleries. Click on that. And the first photo gallery that will come up is called the Kohen Gadol and the Officers of the Temple. And that's going to give the illustrations that will accompany this this study. And the third announcement I'd like to make is within a few weeks, we're going to have a major book that I've been working on for years, published and out for the public. And Gene, let me get you to guess what the title is.
Well, it's something to do with the temple, but I go ahead.
Called,
I'm not sure what you.
It's called Measure the Pattern.
Measure the Pattern. Okay, good. So we're on the cutting edge here. That's a good thing.
Yes, and it's going to cover not the entire temple. It's going to cover actually the quarter buildings around the Azara. The building immediately behind the Azara called the Parbar, and how all of these relates. It answers many of the questions about the various gates, but the function or the purpose of this this book, which is in the first of three, is to arrive at how the temple functioned. And so, very excited about it. I'm very much looking forward to it being sent to the publisher and getting back to
us. Great. So what we're doing here on the show then is absolutely
so with
right.
That, are you ready, Jade?
Absolutely, I am. Let me get back there so that I can read the first Halakha. We're starting, everybody, on Halakha 7 of Chapter 4 of Kli HaMikdash, okay? And I'm going to read the Halakot, and Joe will explain to us what they really mean and what they really have to do with. And, of course, everyone knows the word Halakha, right, that it relates to our walk. And even though it's a Hebrew word, and even though the rabbis use it, we all have a Halakha. And we get to determine what that is, and we need to let Abba determine what that halakha should be. So anyway, with that being said, here's number 7. Similarly, when a priest has a sacrifice of his own, he may come to the temple and offer it on any day that he desires. As that verse states, he shall come at any impulse of his heart's desires and serve. He may even offer his sin offering and guilt offering and bring about atonement for himself. In such an instance, the right to the hide and to partake of the sacrifice belongs to him. If he desires, he may give his sacrifice to any priest he desires to sacrifice it. In such an instance, the right to the hide and to partake of the sacrifice belongs to the priest to whom he gave it.
Okay, Gene. First off, this chapter is going to start off dealing primarily with the Kohanim or the priesthood. And it will also deal specifically with the Kohen Gadol, or the high priest. And it mentions in here, similarly, when a priest has a sacrifice of his own, he may come to the temple and offer it on any day that he desires, as that verse states. And the verse that it's referred to is Deuteronomy 18:8. It says he may even offer his sin offering and guilt offering and bring about atonement for himself. So, Gene, if you can pull up the gallery.
Right. Okay.
We're going to scroll down in the gallery to a picture, which should be the third picture. It will have a building right behind the temple structure called the Parbar that is highlighted.
Yes, okay.
Mm-hmm. All right, now that's where they're going to keep the sin offerings and the trespass or the guilt offerings of the Kohanim. They're kept separate from the other korbanot and those of the normal Israelites. This building, if we can go down to another illustration here, it's called the Parbar in Second Chronicles. But if we could go down... I didn't count how many, but if you'll scroll down, you'll see a black and white picture, and it's a layout of the temple. The actual title of it is Floor Plan Showing Beit Avtinas, Beit Hanitzot, and Dukat. But the reason I selected this picture is because it shows inside the Parbar. So if you can locate the Parbar, there's an X right in the Parbar, and you see all kinds of dots there. And these dots represent columns. And the whole building was nothing but columns. It was divided into two sections, and so they kept the Korban Hatat, the sin offering, on one side, and the Korban Asham on another side.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's where this is also called in the book of Yehezkel, the Gizrah, which means the separate place, or they separated the Korbanot here. And in the Temple Scroll, is called Poror, which is a word that means columns.
Of course, this
took its name from the columns in it.
Right. So it's a stoa. It's another stoa, right? I think we talked about that.
Yes, it's a stoa. And actually, Igal Yadin, who was one of Israel's greatest archaeologists, he's the excavator of Masada, Megiddo, Gezer, Hatzor, all of these places. He, along with his father, who was Professor Susanik, were the ones that secured for Israel the Dead Sea Scrolls. The primary scroll, or the one that excited Yadin the most, was a scroll called the Temple Scroll. And he has published, actually there are two published works on the Temple Scroll, both by Yadin and both called the Temple Scroll. One is a one-volume work. It is published. It's for the general public. It's published by Random House. It's simply called the Temple Scroll. And the other is a four-volume work, which is very detailed. It's a scholar's work published by the Israel Exploration Society. And he wrote a major section on the Paror, or he is the one that tied all of these structures together, the Parbar, the Gizra, and the Paror.
Did I hear you say?
This would be separated.
Uh-huh. Did I hear you say that the Temple Scroll was among the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Yes, and there's a.
Yes, okay.
They didn't secure it with the other scrolls. It was kind of a holdout. It was kept. It was in the possession of a shoemaker, an Arab shoemaker, which is very, very bad. That's bad news. Because, first off, the Arabs had a tendency. The fear was they were going to cut the scrolls up and sell them piecemeal.
Right.
Secondly, if they could not get what they wanted, then they would just make shoes out of them.
Oh, man.
And so in 1967, they knew where the scroll was. Yadin, who was second in command of the Israeli army, he grabbed a private and a jeep while they were still fighting in the city, and he goes straight to the shoemaker's house, finds the scroll in a box under the bed. Quite a story.
Amazing story. Amazing that that came through the way it did. I think that, of course, my personal feeling is that the Dead Sea Scrolls, and this one, of course, as one of them, have been preserved by the hand of the Almighty.
Oh, by all means. In fact, so much of what we know about the temple today is where we were able to first see it. As I mentioned, in this case, was from Yadin's interpretation of the Temple Scroll. Then we could go back into the Tanakh, we could go back into the Mishnah, the various rabbinic texts, go into Josephus, and we would find additional information, and we could build a case for all these.
You know, one thing, too, that I remember us discussing when we were going through these Halakot, you know, it mentions, well, the one I just read, Halakha 7, mentions that the right to the hide and to partake of the sacrifice. And, you know, I think that's something that I didn't really understand until you explained it to me.
Right. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because that's what we were just about to talk about. In this same drawing here, this is a drawing that was done by a close friend of mine, Tom Eldridge, actually for a meeting that I was having with the rabbis. And you'll see the temple building. Okay, so you see the temple building, you see the stairway in front of it, you see the altar, you see the ramp to the left-hand side of it. Then you see a bunch of rings, little dots. These rings are used to, the animals are going to be put into rings when they're slaughtered. Then you have a series of tables and posts. And then if you look, Gene, there is a building. It's number 15.
Okay.
You see that?
Yes, yes, I do.
All right, that building is called, it has a number of names. Now, one of its names is the Beit HaNitzotz, but another name for it is the Beit HaParvar, Parva, P-A-R-V-A-H. Now, the Parva is called the High Chamber.
And okay.
They processed they did an initial processing of the slaughtered animals out of the slaughter area where the rings are, the tables, and there's eight little posts. But they would take them into this building, and they have a chamber in there where they store salt that's used for the korban. They salt the hides. They also salt the sacrifices. They have to do a thorough rinsing. There's a rinsing chamber, and then there is the parva chamber where the hides are dealt with, because the hides belong to the Kohanim. That's their payment for their services, or the hides of all the animals that are slaughtered. Then they take these hides, and they can sell them in the market. They have an income.
So they have great value.
Great value. Yeah. And they are distinctly, from the Torah, these are the possession of the Kohanim. And you see in this halakha that we're reading, it says the right, in such an instance, the right to the hide and to protect the sacrifice belongs to him, belongs to the Kohen, when he brings a sin offering or a korban, a shav, the trespass offering, it says that that hide belongs to him. But if he desires, he can give his sacrifice to any Kohen he desires to sacrifice it. In such an instance, the right to the hide and to partake of the sacrifice belongs to the priest to whom he gave it. So he's given up his right to what he would receive back on this.
Ah, okay, yeah. So that's why, you know, setting these halakot and making it clear as to exactly how these things were handled was very important, because you're talking about a livelihood here. You're talking about part of the way that the priests were able to sustain themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, man. Okay. Okay. You ready for Halakha 8?
Let's do it.
Okay. If the priest who brings the sacrifice is physically blemished, he should give his sacrifice to the priests of the watch serving that week, and the hide belongs to them. If he was ill or sick to the extent that he could serve only with difficulty, he may give the sacrifice to any priest he desires. The hide and the service belong to the priests of the watch serving that week. If he cannot serve at all, the sacrifice belongs to the priests of the watch serving that week in its entirety.
Isn't this amazing that it covers in the event if somebody has sick leave or
right,
somebody's
exactly.
unable to fill his duties? How is this executed?
You right, know, yeah,
it's covering all questions.
Yeah, it's amazing how practical it all is.
Exactly.
That's the thing that struck me, because when I first started looking at all this with you, Joe, I thought, oh, this is all sort of that's we're sort of off in this other world of the temple, and that it probably wouldn't contain a whole lot of simple practical realities. But boy, if there's anything I've noticed, there's a ton of reality here. I mean, Abba is the ultimate realist.
Yes,
and he sets up his rules to fit every instance.
Exactly.
So
okay, how
okay.
about that?
Yes. If all the priests of the watch are impure and a communal sacrifice is involved and all of the priests were impure, the sacrifice may be given to the priests of that watch who were ritually pure but have physical blemishes. The hide and the service belong to the priests of the watch serving that week, even though they are impure.
Okay, so it's taken it a step further. In the event that for some reason the entire priest that are qualified physically to serve in the temple, but they become impure, it will go to the priests that are not physically qualified. In other words, they have a blemish. They're not allowed to service. They are not allowed to serve in the Azarah, in the inner courtyard. They have other areas that they serve, but it will go to them if they're ritually pure, and then the hide and the service belong to the priest of the entire watch, whether they are pure or impure.
Right, right. Okay, Halakha 10.
Yes.
If the sacrifice belonged to the high priest and he was in a state of acute mourning, and you have a description for that, but I'll let you do that, he may give it to any priest he desires. The hide and the service belong to the priests of the watch serving that week. The rationale is that since a high priest is fit to perform service in a state of acute mourning, as will be explained, he may appoint an agent for his sacrifice.
All right. So This is a very interesting halakha to me, where it says that the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, was in a state of acute mourning. That means that an immediate family member has died that day.
That very day?
That very day.
Wow. Okay. Okay.
He may give it to any priest he desires. Now, the key word in here is he may give it.
Ah, okay.
Okay. The hide of the service belonged to the priest of the watch serving that week. The rationale is that since a high priest is fit to perform service in a state of acute mourning, as will be explained, he may, and again, it's that word may, appoint an agent, a shliach, for his sacrifice. And that agent literally becomes the very name of the high priest. He's operating in his name. And so it's as the high priest were there himself operating.
Ah, okay. I get it. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
Do you want to look at the next
11.
One? 11.
Yes.
The head of every watch divides his watch into clans so that the priests in each clan will serve on one of the days of the week, one on one day, another on the next, and another on the next. Each of the clans had a head who was appointed over it.
All right. What we have... I'm going to read a couple of Mishnah-ot, and this will be found in the tractate Midot. Midot is in Seder Kodeshim from the Mishnah, and it deals, Midot literally means measurements. And let me get turned there. This is in Midot. 1:1 is where it starts. It starts telling about the places in Midot 1:1 where the various Kohanim, the Kohanim and the Levim stood watch. Then it goes into how they did the inspection of the temple during the night. Then it goes into the various gates into the temple mount. And as we move forward, it goes to a description of the chamber for the chamber for the priest. So I want to go back to another picture here in the temple gallery.
Okay.
And the picture we're going to select this time. Is from the top, it would be the sixth picture down, I believe.
Okay.
Fifth picture down. And this is called the Beit HaMoked. And it's on the northwestern quarter. Now, what Beit HaMoked means is House of the Hearth, because this is the dormitory where the priests that are on duty for a week. They come on duty on the Shabbat, and they go off duty the following week.
Right.
And so they're going to be in this building. This is going to be their quarters, and they will sleep here.
Uh-huh.
So let me read about the Beit HaMoked. It says there were four chambers in Beit HaMoked, like side rooms, opening to a drawing room, two in the sanctified area, and two in the unsanctified area. And the ends of beams separated the sanctified area from the unsanctified area. And what was their function? The southwestern one was the chamber of the sacrificial lambs. The southeastern one was the chamber of the makers of the lechem hapanim, that's the bread of the feast. The northeastern one, in it the Hasmoneans stored the stones of the altar, which the kings of Greece had contaminated. The northwestern one, through it, they would descend to the place of immersion. So I want to hold my hand here, and I'm going to turn back into the tractate Tabi, which deals with the daily sacrifices.
I think I hear a break coming on, Joe. Hang on. Everybody stick with us. We will be back after this break. Okay, Joe. You were in the process of starting to read to us out of one of the Mishnot. So I will get out of your way and let you continue.
All right, this is from Tractate Talmid. It's a sister passage to the one we read in Midot.
Okay.
It's describing the Beit HaMokad and the chambers. Now, just to review what we read before, is it tells us that there are four chambers in the Beit HaMokad. There's actually more than that, but these are four specific ones. We have in the if you look at the building, go to the upper left-hand corner of the building, and there was a chamber there where they kept the tamid, the lambs that are going to be offered one in the morning, one in the afternoon. That's the continual offering. Then in the southeastern corner, and there's a gate that runs through it on the extreme eastern side. So it's going to be north of that gate, west of that gate. It was the bakery for the Lechem HaPanim, the bread of the face, the showbread. Then you have a chamber that they were told they stored the stones of the altar that were desecrated by Antiochus during the time of the Hasmoneans. And then you're told in the northwestern corner that there was a masiba, a winding stairway that went down. So we have to go to Tamid, and it tells us the names of these two chambers. And so it says, and four chambers were there. One was the chamber of the lambs. We already talked about that. One was the chamber of tokens. Now, the chamber of tokens is where that's in the northeastern corner. That's the chamber where they stored the stones of the altar. What was the chamber of Beit HaMokad? It's called the Lishkat Beit HaMokad. That's the room where the Kohanim slept. That's their quarters. And the Masiba's in the corner of that room. And what was the chamber where they would make the Lechem HaPanim? Okay, so I'm going to go back to Midot. It says, in Midot 1:7, there were two gates in Beit HaMokad, one opening to the Kel, and one opening to the Azarah. Rabbi Yehuda said the one that opened to the Azarah had a small wicket through which they would enter to inspect the Azarah. Midot 1:8. Beit HaMokad, a dome. The Hebrew word that you have here is kippah. It was a large structure surrounded by stone slabs. It, catch this. It says the elders of the Beit Av would sleep there. Okay? So the elders of the house. This is the family group that is the mishmar, or the cores, or the division that will be over the entire week's services.
Okay, so that changes once a week, every Shabbat,
yes.
Right?
Every okay. Shabbat. So notice that it's plural. The elders of the Beit Av would sleep there.
Right.
And the keys of the Azarah were in their hands. Again, it's plural. And the young Kohanim, each one was his cushion on the ground. Then Midot 1:9 says there was a place there, an amma by an amma, cubit by cubit, and a slab of marble and a ring was fixed to it, and a chain on which were hanging the keys with the rod. He lifted up the slab by the ring and took the keys from the chain. Okay, so notice how it changed from the elders, and that they had keys and they slept over the keys. Now it's become singular. Okay, so it says the Kohen, singular, locked up from inside, and a Levite slept outside. When he finished locking up, he returned to the keys, to the chain, and the slab to its place. He placed his garment on it. He went to sleep. All right. So here the Mishnah goes on, has a lot of interesting information. But we have one who is called the Rosh Beit Av. He's the head of the house. He is the oldest member of this Mishmar. Now, there are other elders that are there with him, but they each have responsibilities, and these responsibilities are related in the keys. However, the keys are going to be collected together, and they're going to go to the Rosh Beit Av, and he will put them on a ring, and he literally sleeps over them after he's locked up the building. He will divide the Kohanim. Each elder will have a group of Kohanim. And so he'll say, okay, on Yom Rishon, which is the first day of the week, what people generally call Sunday, He will say, all right, Elder number one, your group's going to take care of this day. Then he'll go to Rosh Shadi the second day, and he'll or the Yom Shadi, and he'll go to Elder number two, and he'll say, your Kohanim are going to take care of the service on this day. We'll choose all the different positions from your group. So they're like platoons in a company, platoons in a battalion. All right.
Right. Now, one thing that you and I talked about in our discussion was that it was, I think that Rambam suggested that that while one did not have the immediate duty for that day, he was free to go elsewhere. And you're saying you don't agree with that.
No, I don't agree with that. I believe that they're on duty the entire week.
Right. They're there whether or not they're serving that day or not. They're still on the premises.
Right. We're told that even the Kohanim that were disqualified because they had a blemish, they're not going to be sleeping in the an impurity.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that they will come and be present in the temple as the services are being conducted to show that they're not being lax.
Right, exactly. I mean, one thing that has struck me throughout our entire study of the temple has been the degree of enthusiasm displayed by everyone involved.
Oh, that's been so inspirational to me, is that I see this as a model for our lives. That
right.
We should have the same type of zeal towards what God has called us to.
Right. In other words, don't get so comfortable in your job or in your duty that you feel like you can walk in there and do it with arrogance and with sloppiness.
Exactly.
Yep.
Okay. Gene, you ready to go to the next one?
Yes. A high priest is appointed to serve as the head of all the priests. He is anointed with the anointing oil and clothed in the garments of the high priest, as Leviticus 21:10 states. And the priest who is elevated over his brethren and over whose head was poured the anointment oil. If there is no anointment oil, he is initiated into office merely by wearing the garments of the high priest, as the above verse states, over whose head was poured the anointment oil and who was initiated to wear the garments. Implied is that just as he initiated with the anointment oil, so too he is initiated with the garments of the high priesthood.
Right. The anointing oil was originally made by Moses, and they made it for all time. So an additional batch of the anointing oil is never manufactured. During the reign of King Yoshiaku or Josiah, who is the fifth from the last kings of Judah, the oil was hidden, along with the ark and other items. And so that's why it's referencing if a priest assumes office without the anointing of the oil, then this is the way it's done.
Ah, okay. I see. Okay, and I recall us talking about that several Sundays back when we discussed the amount of anointing oil that was created. I mean, there was enough made to last throughout all of history till now.
And it's also believed that anointing oil would be found once again.
Right, and be put back into use.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was necessary that they write all this down.
Right, exactly. Okay, Halakha 13. How is he initiated with the garments? He puts on the eight garments of the high priest and later removes them and does so again on the morrow for 7 days. As Exodus 29:30 states, the priest from his sons who serves in his stead shall put them on for 7 days. Just as he puts on the clothes for 7 consecutive days, so too he is anointed with the oil for 7 consecutive days. If he performs service before he was initiated by wearing the clothes for all 7 days, or before he was anointed for all 7 days, his service is acceptable. Since he was initiated or anointed once, he is a high priest with regard to all matters.
All right. So let's talk about this one. We have the high priest. First off, you have a difference in the garments between a normal priest and a high priest. The
right.
Normal priest has 4 garments, and they're all white. The high priest has those 4 garments plus 4 more. And these are called the golden vestments. So that's why you have eight garments. Now, only the high priest is able to wear them. There's going to be an exception to this. When a priest serves as high priest, leading Israel to war. And he's allowed at that time to wear, but that's a temporary high priest situation. Now, here in the United States, we have a president right now. We have President Obama. But
right.
George Bush, we still call him Mr. President when he's addressed.
Right.
And he will be called Mr. President, and his father will be called Mr. President until they pass.
Right.
Because that is an honor, a distinction that they will carry for all time. So in the late Second Temple period, from the time of Herod going forward all the way to the destruction of the temple in 70 Common Era, the position was bought and sold, first by Herod and then later by the Romans. And so you could have five, six, seven different high priests living at the same time, but they are all called by the title of high priest.
Even though that was not really the intention.
That was right? Not the intention, but that because of the Torah, it was necessary.
Right. Right. Okay. Okay. Halakha 14. There's no difference in the laws pertaining to a high priest who is anointed with the anointment oil and those applying to one who was initiated by wearing the garments of the high priest, except the obligation for the high priest to bring a bull as a sacrifice if he inadvertently violated one of the mitzvot for which a sin offering is required. As Leviticus 4:3 states, if the anointed priest will sin, with regard to other matters, they are identical.
Right, and the wording here, and Gene, you and I, when we were talking about what we were going to present, we did not really make this stand out in our conversation. But it says, if the anointed priest will sin.
Right.
And you have one that was not anointed because they didn't have the anointing oil.
Right.
Then the one that does not have the anointing oil was not required to bring the bull as a sacrifice.
Right, right.
So
I understand.
It's paying particular attention to the wording of the Torah.
Yeah, and that's and that's another thing I think that maybe we need to just point out is the fact that things are so specific here, and I mean it almost has the feeling of a legal document. It has the feeling of everything being laid out just so that there's no question under any circumstances what you would do.
It is a legal document.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the whole deal. And that, now that we are coming back into the time, I believe, when there will be another temple in shorter time than anybody possibly imagines, getting to know this legal document is just becoming that much more important all over again.
Yes, and I honestly believe that the study of the temple brings that to the forefront. You have to look at it as a legal document in order to understand how it functioned, even what its purpose was. This is a shortfalling. There is a difference between how an Orthodox Jew reads the same words of the Torah that you and I read. It will come away with different perceptions of what's being communicated because he, from his childhood, has been taught to read it as a legal document.
Right. And, of course, also, having been taught all of these various aspects of the temple, he's going to spot things in the text in the Tanakh that the rest of us just go right over and don't notice. That's something I've noticed, is once you and I have gone over some of these things and then read the Tanakh again, the same passage, it has an entirely different meaning, and it just jumps off the page.
Yes.
So, okay. Halakha 15. A high priest should be appointed only by the court of 71 judges, otherwise known as the Sanhedrin, right?
Yes, that's the Sanhedrin.
Okay. He should be anointed only during the day, as Leviticus 6:13 states, on the day of his anointment. Similarly, if he was initiated merely by wearing the priestly garments, the initiation should only take place during the day. Two high priests should not be initiated together.
All right. This is a really exciting halakha to me. I have, since the 1980s, been working on the temple research. And from the very first, I had a dream of the temple being rebuilt.
Yes.
And however, I knew fairly soon after I got started that it would require, for a new temple to be rebuilt, there were a number of things that would have to happen. There would have to be a red heifer ceremony, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay. We have to have the cleansing of the temple, the cleansing of the priest, and the cleansing of the worshipers with the ashes of the red heifer. And in studying the red heifer, we find out that it was initially given to Aaron or Aaron to perform, and he appointed his son Eleazar to actually perform the ceremony. But it is the right of the high priest to perform the ceremony. He is the only one that can initiate another priest to take his place. So by logic, you realize that, well, if you don't have a high priest, you can't have a red heifer ceremony.
Right.
And if you don't have a red heifer ceremony, you can't have a temple.
Right.
And
they all tie together.
Sanhedrin.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Okay, so in other words, as we discussed in the past, the young men that are being raised right now behind closed doors, preparatory for that day, will in effect, whoever it is that ends up doing it, will in effect function as a high priest.
No. That's not okay. Correct. Well, he will function as a high priest, but he will not be the high priest.
Yeah, right. But I mean, since there will be no high priest there, he'll take over that duty for that specific initiation, right?
Let me back up. I want to add to what you said here.
Okay.
The Sanhedrin will appoint a high priest.
Uh-huh.
Then the high priest will appoint another priest, or actually a group of priests, because it takes several, in order to perform the red heifer ceremony.
Ah, okay.
Okay.
Yep.
And so they are standing in, the one that slaughters the red heifer and will sprinkle the blood towards the holy place. He is standing in for the high priest, but he's not the high priest.
I see. Okay,
but
you
have to have a Sanhedrin to have a high priest to appoint that priest to do that. So
this feels like a whole row of dominoes.
It is a row of dominoes.
You're missing one domino, and it fails.
So as early as the early 1990s, I began to pray that the Sanhedrin would be reinstituted. Mm-hmm. In 2004, and I actually believe that Hashem allowed me to be in Jerusalem at the time that it occurred. In 2004, I was in Jerusalem, and Rabbi Richman from the Temple Institute, we had been, I think, on a television show together. We've been friends for years and years, almost 30 years. And he asked me if I could bring a suitcase over for him, that he had so much stuff that he wasn't going to be able to take back everything he had, and he had this extra suitcase. So I told him, yes, and my next trip I'll bring it over for you. Well, I had been watching all the Israeli newspapers and everything for some hint that there would be a move towards establishing a Sanhedrin. And basically, there was very little. So in 2004, we were there in the month of Heshvan, which is October. And my group was going to the southern steps of the temple in the Ophel. Now, I hired an archaeologist who's very prominent right now. Back at that time, she was still a student working on her doctorate. Her name was Orit Peleg. And she had worked as the assistant to Dr. Ilat Mazar, who had excavated this area. So I hired Orit to take my group. Well, I didn't want to... I wanted them to get what she had to say. She could show all kinds of things that because she was there at the dig and working directly with Dr. Mazar, that would be fascinating. So I took advantage of the time to go back up into the Jewish quarter to Rabbi Richman's office, carrying a suitcase. When I walked in the door, he handed me a a Rutsheva newspaper that he had printed out off his printer. It said that the evening before, which actually was this very same day, that in Tiberias, they had reinstituted the Sanhedrin. And
was there a reason why? Yeah, I apologize. Sorry to interrupt you, Joe. Is there a reason why it was instituted in Tiberias?
Yes, there is. The last Sanhedrin was disbanded by the Roman Emperor Theodosius II, who is a Byzantine emperor, and he made it illegal for them to meet. And the last place that the Sanhedrin met was there in Tiberias.
And
do you know what their last action was?
If I recall, it was instituting the calendar of Hillel.
That's correct, because they knew that they would no longer be able to set the calendar, which was required by the Torah for them to set it. And so the only way around this was to institute a published calendar.
Right, a formula, basically, right?
Yes, a formula.
That allows everyone to calculate independently and arrive at the same place.
That's correct. Yeah. Now, here's an interesting side story. Months before, there was an archaeological dig taking place in Tiberias. And they had discovered a huge building. And they had determined that this was the last quarters of the Sanhedrin, the one that was shut down. And they had kept it secret. And they had made the announcement of the discovery of the building on the very same day that the Sanhedrin was reinstituted.
Well, that sounds like way more than an accident.
Right, and both of these took place in Tiberias, within just a short distance from one another, without either group knowing what the other was doing.
Amazing.
You see the hand of God.
Right. You know, I want to mention one thing about the calendar issue, because as you know, Joe, the calendar is a huge cause of strife and division amongst a lot of people who are rediscovering their Hebrew roots right now. And one thing I want to point out, because, you know, you've got all these people out there, and I'm one of them. I like the idea of looking for the Aviv and, you know, and doing all the natural things that the priests did. But, you know, the thing that strikes me about this is that the Sanhedrin did not institute Hillel's calendar to be somehow or other controlling. They were just trying to save everybody to the same practice, since they were not going to be able to hear from Jerusalem and to hear from the temple as they had in the past. They were just trying to come up with something that would work until everything was restored, right?
That's correct.
And, you know, so their intentions were good. You know, they weren't trying to control everybody, you know, and I think I hear a lot of people talking about how, well, you know, those rabbis, they keep trying to control us. I think they were trying to come up with something that would work until everything was restored. I'm sorry, Joe, go ahead.
Just all I was going to add is that to keep from there being division and confusion and strife.
Right, exactly. And that's, I mean, anybody with a lick of sense would have done the same thing. You know, and as you and I have discussed, ever since I'll tell you what, there's a break. I'll finish my sentence after the break. Talk to you a little bit. All right, we're back for the second hour of today's Measure the Pattern. And I just want to emphasize to you that we really do have the chat room open today. I'm going to open it a few times and see if people actually show up. I do have one gentleman there right now. And anybody else that would like to join us, please feel free. We would really like to. We want input here. This is a group discussion. I want this to feel like we're all sitting around, you know, the coffee table in Joe's house talking about the temple. And Joe, there's no better person on earth, in my opinion, than Joe to tell us about what the temple has, what it relates to, how we relate to it. Okay, Joe. I don't even remember what I was saying, but anyway, I think I was just making the point that. That we need to understand that many of the things that were done that we have attributed to rabbinical control modes actually had nothing to do with control modes. It had to do with trying to make some kind of a decision that would help everybody stay together while there was no Sanhedrin and while there was no temple, right?
Yes, and also how without the temple, without the Sanhedrin, how that the commandments could continue to be followed where it would be applicable, according to what the Torah said, to keep it within the confines of the Torah.
Exactly, and I think that's we really need to understand that. Oh, I know what that was. I was saying is after you've shown me these things especially in the Mishnayot about the temple, I've gone back and read the same passage in the Tanakh, and suddenly it's full of incredible information, and it's just amazing.
It is. It's amazing. I relate it to when I was a kid. My mother would take my sister and I to the grocery store along with her. And the very first place that we went to, she back then the kids could roam around a lot more than they can today. We went to the cereal aisle, and we selected the cereal that we wanted to buy, and that was based on what was the toy inside.
That's right.
You did that too, I'm sure.
Yep. Yes.
I remember the Frogman. I really loved the Frogman that you put the little baking soda in. At any rate, my sister, she really liked to get these boxes of cereal that on the back it had these drawings, and it would show like a jungle scene, and it would have the question: how many birds can you find in the jungle? And I would look at that, and it looked like, well, a bunch of plants, trees, flowers. I didn't see any birds. But she would look at it, and she could see those birds. And so she would point them out to me. Once she pointed them out to me, that's the first thing my eye would see when I came back to it.
Right.
And so that's what happens here.
Yeah, but truly is a matter of perception. And we need to get our perception wrapped around this. We need to get to the point where we see the temple in context. Because right now, I don't think very many believers at all really have an overview of what they believe that includes a holy temple. And we need to restore that. At least that's Gene Porter's opinion.
And I second that one.
All right, Holocaust 16?
Yes. We're going to go into the administration of the temple now.
Okay. We also appoint a priest who will serve the high priest like a viceroy. He is called the Segan, and he is also called the Appointed One. He should stand at the right hand of the high priest at all times. This honor is given to him. All of the other priests are under his authority.
Do you know what Segan means, Gene?
No. What does it mean?
It means deputy.
Oh, okay. Okay.
In the Israeli Army, I've had the privilege of raising funds for a particular unit of the Israeli Army, one of the tank brigades on the Golan Heights. Mm-hmm. And you have a colonel is the brigade commander, and then you have the Segan, who is his deputy, and he's the deputy brigade commander. Then you have the battalions, which are they're headed by a lieutenant colonel, and then you have his Segan over the battalion, and that's the deputy commander. And so it's in that light, and we see he's like the viceroy. He's like in England you have a king and you have a prime minister, and so he's called the appointed one because he is appointed. He stands at the right hand of the priest at all times, and he has authority over all the other priest. And so he keeps the high priest from having to do all the administrative duties.
Right, but he is appointed by the high priest. He is not selected in any other way. So he is a selected assistant for the high priest.
Yes.
Gotcha. Okay. Holocaust 17. In addition,
I'll tell you, before we read that, I want to go to Ford a little bit here in Klei HaMikdash to chapter 5.
Okay.
In chapter 5, I want to go to Holocaust 4.
Okay.
Are you there?
I'm waiting for my, there we go. Okay, got there. Okay, Halakha 4.
Now, this is talking about the high priest.
Yes, okay, I've got it. You want me to read it?
Yes, if you could read that.
Sure. He should not enter, and by the way, we're talking, he is the high priest, I'm assuming, right?
Right.
Let's see. I just want to make sure.
It's the high priest, which you have in the preceding Halakha. The high priest must conduct himself with dignity.
Right, okay. So, Halakha 4 of chapter 5
yes.
goes like this. He should not enter a celebration or a public feast, even if they are associated with a mitzvah, if he desires a house of mourning. If he goes, he does not go walking together with the other priests. Instead, the priests surround him and display honor to him, and the segan arranges the contact between him and the people. The segan and an anointed priest who is removed from his position stand at his right, and the head of the clan serving in the temple, the mourners, and all others are to his left. He tells the mourners, be comforted, and they honor him according to their capacity.
All right, so you kind of see how the segan operates there.
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, you know, I want to, could I say something real quick, Joe? Just relative to how this struck me today, because I studied this entire chapter preparatory for this evening, and for the longest time, I was sitting there going, this is dumb. This seems like they give way too much honor to a man, you know, reading all through these halakot, and I'm going, this doesn't feel like Yah. But then I think to myself, how do people treat the president? And I think about the way in which the president is honored customarily. And suddenly, it didn't feel so weird to me then. Because there was a long stretch there. I had every intention of asking you, don't you think that men came up with some of this stuff? You know, but the more I think about it, the more I think that, no, these are honors. These are honors that are due to him in his position.
Gene, I'm really glad you brought this up, because there's a passage, and if I can find it, out of the Acts, where Paul is going to make a statement towards the high priest, not realizing that he is the high priest, and he immediately apologizes.
Ah, yes, okay.
Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can find it. Yes, it's, I believe, in chapter 23.
23 of Acts, okay. Oh, yeah. Yes, right at the very beginning there.
Mm-hmm. Right. Actually, the last verse of chapter 22 says, the next day, because he wanted to know for certain why he was accused by the Jews, he released him from his bonds and commanded the chief priest and all their council to appear and brought Paul down and set him before them. Then Paul, looking earnestly at the council, said, men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. And the high priest Ananias. Now, Ananias was not actually the high priest serving at that time.
Okay.
He was the father-in-law of Caiaphas.
Okay. So was he one of those bought and sold high priests?
Yes, very much so.
Okay.
But the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. So he doesn't like Ananias. For you sent to judge me according to the Torah. And do you command me to be struck contrary to the Torah? And those who stood by said, do you revile God's high priest? Then Paul said, I did not know, brethren, that he was the high priest. For it is written, you shall not speak evil of the ruler of your people. And then it goes on. So we see Paul respected the office.
Right. In essence, he apologized.
Yes. Yes. And there was honor and respect due the office of the high priest.
Right, right. Even though Ananias may not have personally deserved much honor or respect, nonetheless, in that position, Paul still felt as though he had to treat him as such.
That's correct.
Ah, man, that's important stuff. That helps us understand the relationships that we're going to have as things are restored.
Gene, can we read the fifth Halakha, chapter 5?
Sure, you bet. If one of the relatives for whom he must mourn dies, He does not go out to the funeral procession, nor does he depart from the entrance of his home or the temple. All of the nation comes to his home to comfort him. He stands for the line of comforters with the Segan at his right and the head of the clan to his left. The people tell him, "We are atonement for you." And he tells them, "May you be blessed from heaven."
Okay. So I want to just fully develop, you know, how the Segan works and get a little insight into the high priest and how they had to deal with these various matters. Mm-hmm. Okay, we can go back now to chapter 4.
Okay.
And I believe that we're at Halakha 17.
Okay, let me get back there real quick here. I've got to get my... There we go. Okay, and Halakha 17. Okay. Just one second and I'll be there. Just waiting for my computer to catch up with me here. Oh, come on now. Okay. Now we... Okay, 17. Okay, here we go. In addition, katikolin are appointed to serve the Segan as the Segan serves the high priest. There should be no less than two of them. No less than seven Amerkalin should be appointed. The keys to the temple courtyard are in their hands. If one desires to open the courtyard, he cannot until all the Amerkalin gather and open it.
Okay. It's getting into the hierarchy with the high priest at the top, the Segan below him, the deputy. Now we're going to have the katakulid, and let me read the note that we have on that. It says it's just a Greek term meaning general officer. Now, it is commentary to the Mishnah in Shekelim 5:2. The Rambam states that there should never be fewer than two people appointed to take care of communal matters. So I'm going to read 5:2 out of the Mishnah.
Okay.
It says there were no less than three treasurers and seven supervisors. And we have there should be no less than three treasurers and seven supervisors, nor is authority set up over the community in money with less than two, except for Ben Ahia over the stomach disorders, and Eleazar over the curtains. The curtains are going to be the parochet, the veils, who
right.
The majority of the community accepted over themselves.
Right. And by the way, just real quickly, you'll know, everybody out there, you heard Joe talk about someone who was given charge over the stomach disorders. There actually were Levites, who were in charge of taking care of the Kohanim who had stomach problems as a result of all the meat that they ate. Is that correct?
That's correct. This is in the preceding Mishnah. It's in Shekelim 5:1. And I'll just read the part. There's 15 different administrators. And we have, let's see, let me find it. Yes, Benahia over the stomach disorders. And I'll read the little note that we have with that. And Benahia over stomach disorders. The Jerusalem Talmud explains that the Kohanim suffered stomach disorders because they worked barefoot on the floor and ate a lot of meat and drank water. And this man was charged with treating and healing them. So it's basically the first aid station.
Now, I have another question too that just struck me as you were as we were discussing Halakha 17 there. These terms that we used, katikolin and amerkalin, you said they're Greek terms. Why
well,
on earth?
Katikolin is.
Okay, okay.
Katikolin
why
is, but the amerkalin is not.
Okay, why would they use a Greek term to describe officers in the Hebrew temple?
You know, I've wondered that same question. And I've been looking. In fact, I've got a number of texts here, and I was going to read some of these notes, and maybe we'll learn a little bit as we go, but I don't honestly know.
Yeah, that's really struck me oddly there.
Okay, so
again, these positions were appointive, and they were appointed by the Sagan, who was appointed by the high priest. So we're going down the hierarchy here, right?
Yes.
Okay.
If we could picture it like this, it's kind of like the president in his cabinet.
Uh-huh.
Okay. There were no less than three treasurers. I'm reading the commentary from Shekelim 5:2. In charge of the temple funds, they would redeem consecrated items, and all the temple work was performed by them, and seven supervisors. They were in charge of the temple treasures, and they were superior to the treasurers. We learn in Tosefta, what do the seven supervisors do? They hold the seven keys to the temple courtyard. Each one had one key. If one wished to open up, he could not do so until all were present. And the supervisors opened up and the treasurers entered. Rabbi Yehuda said, why were these the supervisors known as the Markel? That's spelled different than what we have with Rabbah. It's spelled A-M-A-R-K-A-L. Because they are the masters, which is the word mar, M-A-R, over kol, K-O-L, over everything. And so a Markel comes from this word, Amar, or Bar, Kol. The Jerusalem Talmud states that that above the supervisors were two other officials known as the Katalikos, so it's spelled different again here, which means overseers. And according to Rambam, there were five levels of authority. Now, this fascinated me, Gene. The five levels are at the top. So you might, if you're diagramming this, you might want to put an A, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest.
Right.
Under him, B, the deputy Kohen Gadol. That's the Sagan.
Right.
C, the two Katalikos are overseers.
Mm-hmm.
D, the seven supervisors. That's the Markal. And E, the three treasures.
Ah, okay. Now, I noticed also in Halakha 17, the keys to the temple courtyard are in the hands of the Amerikalin, and if you want to open the courtyard, the temple courtyard, which is the Azarah, right?
Yes.
Okay, you can't open it unless you have all seven of the Amerikalin there to gather and open it.
Yes. That's security.
Boy, it sure is. That's amazing.
I mean, it's a protocol
mm-hmm.
that guarantees that everything within the temple is in order.
Yes. And once again, eminently practical.
Yeah. So I pulled down the Tosefta and also the Talmud Yashami. And I thought that we would take a look at that. And this is going to be in the Tractate Shekelim. And we have in Shekelim 2:15, the three revenuers. What do they do? Through them, people will redeem or pay off valuations, declarations of harim, acts of consecration and second tithe, and all the work of supervision of acts of consecration was done by them. The seven supervisors, what do they do? The seven keys to the courtyard are in their hand. If one of them wanted to open up, he could not do so unless all seven came together. Once all seven of them came together, the supervisors opened the gates, and the revenuers go in and come out. And in order of rank did they go in and come out. Said Rabbi Yehuda, what is the title of Markal? Because he is master over all. They were suitable folk chosen from the priesthood, Levites or Israelites. He who had a son, his son takes precedence. If he had a brother, the brother takes precedence. Whoever takes precedence in inheritance takes precedence in positions of authority, so long as he follows the custom of his forefathers. You see, we got some extra information there.
Right.
Now I'm going to go to the Talmud Yashami, and this also is in Tractate Shekelim. And let me. Yes, this is Shekely 5-2. They appoint no fewer than 3 reviewers and 7 supervisors. They do not appoint fewer than 2 people to a public position of supervision in property matters. Except for Ben-Ahia, who is in charge of the bowel sickness, and Eleazar, who is in charge of Haggis. For then did the majority of the congregation accept. They appoint no fewer than 3 reviewers and 7 supervisors. It has been taught they do not appoint fewer than 2 financial officers. This is in line with that which is written. While Yehiel, Azariah, Nahat, Ashahel, Yerobod, Yozabad, Eliel, Ismachia, Mahat, and Madiah were overseers assisting Konaniah and Shimei his brother by the appointment of Hizkiah or Hezekiah the king and Azariah the chief officer of the house of God. 2 Chronicles chapter 31:13. And I want to read a little bit more, Gene, because this gets fascinating. Sure. Now as to the king and high priest, when he signs a document, the treasurer signs it and gives it to his supervisor, to the supervisor. The supervisor signs it and gives it to the financial officer. The financial officer signs it and gives it to the high priest. The high priest signs it and gives it to the king. Now, when he undoes the document, the king examines his signature and undoes it. The high priest examines his signature and undoes it. The financial officer examines his signature and undoes it. The supervisor examines his signature and undoes it. The treasurer examines his signature and undoes it. And then it goes on. Anything pop in mind?
No, you go ahead.
All right, I want to go to the book of Revelation.
Okay.
Chapter 4.
Okay.
Chapter 5, excuse me. Verse 1, and I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll written inside and on the back, sealed with 7 seals. Now, then I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the scroll and to loose its seals. In other words, you have something that is in the minds of the people of how a scroll wasn't just opened. Mm-hmm. It was opened by a process. And there were all these seals that had to go on it, a scroll of a legal document.
Another break. We'll be right back after this break. Okay, Joe, before the break, you were showing us 5 levels of approval on documents that went through the temple to the king. And now you got us in Revelation with 7 seals. Go ahead.
Right. The 7 sealed scroll deals with who's worthy to open it. Okay, so it's basically the king who has to that has the authority to open it.
Right.
And so, of course, we have the Messiah here. But you have this idea of a 7 sealed scroll. That means there's going to be 7 levels of opening it.
Right.
Each of the officials have different. They have to put their seal on it, and they're required to be there. Now, here's the point, is that the book of Revelation, which was written by Yochanan HaShliach, or John the Apostle, was also a Kohen.
Right.
He was a priest. His mother, his family were priests. And so he wrote the book of Revelation as well as the Gospel of John using temple phraseology and idioms throughout. His audience, his Jewish audience, they understood this terminology. When we come to it, we have no idea what a 7 sealed scroll means.
That's right.
And that there's a chain of order. And so, again, as you learn the temple, it's going to open up all types of passages, not only through the Tanakh, but through the New Testament.
Okay, so what you're saying is we just got done seeing 5 levels of approval with the temple officials all the way up to the high priest to the king. Here we've got seven levels, so we've got two extra levels, right?
Yes.
Okay. And
I can't tell you what those two levels are, but but I am confident that the people understood what those levels would be back then.
Right. Right. Yeah. My guess is Moshiach and Hashem. That's my guess. Anyway, but then I only get one guess. So.
Okay. Let's head back to Mishneh Torah.
Yes. Okay. Back to chapter 4, and I think that we were 18. Treasurers are appointed under the Amerkalin. There should be no less than three. They collect the consecrated articles, redeem those which should be redeemed, and use the proceeds for purposes that require these expenses.
Okay, so they're in charge of all the money matters, the financial matters.
Right, and you see where they fit in that hierarchy. They're underneath the Amerkalin.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Halakha 19. A high priest who is anointed receives precedence over one who was installed by wearing the garments of the high priesthood. One installed by wearing the garments who is prepared to serve receives precedence over an anointed high priest disqualified because of a seminal emission. One disqualified because of a seminal emission receives precedence over one disqualified because of a physical blemish. One disqualified because of a physical blemish receives precedence over the priest anointed to lead the nation in war. The priest anointed to lead the nation in war receives precedence over the Sigan. The Sigan receives precedence over a Katikol over an Amerikal over a treasurer over a head of a watch over a head of a clan, and a head of a clan over an ordinary priest. Thus, there are eight rungs in the priesthood, one above the other.
All right, so you have a hierarchy that's described here.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we have a very interesting priest that's mentioned here. The priest anointed to lead the nation in war receives precedence over the Sagan. And so we have this is covered in the Tractate Nazir. The Nazir is the tractate that deals with the laws of the Nazirite.
Right.
Do you know what the word Nazir means?
That doesn't mean. I think it means a branch, right?
No.
No. Okay.
No. Nazir means to separate.
Oh, to separate. Okay. Okay.
And so, when one becomes a Nazir, he separates from certain items.
Yes. Oh, okay. Yes. It's like the Nazirite vow.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's in the tractate. In the tractate Nazir. Let me see if I can tell you exactly where. I don't know if I can or not. Give me a second, and I'll tell you where it's going to deal with the priest who is anointed to lead. In the time of war. Yeah, have you ever heard of this priest, Gene, before?
What, the one, you mean a war priest? A priest who specifically was empowered to lead in time of war?
Yes.
No, not ever as a function like this, no.
All right. Let me see. I want to pull up which of the Mishnayot deals with the priest that leads in the time of war.
Now, was the one who led us in a time of war like that, was he always a high priest?
No, he's appointed by the high priest.
Ah, okay, okay. Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking in an overview of the tractate Nazir, what we're told here is Nazir 47b, which is the Babylonian Talmud, states that with regard to providing one with his livelihood and appointed to lead the nation in war receives precedence over the Sagan because the nation as a whole is dependent on him. Then we have another note. The priest appointed to lead the nation in war is not counted because he is not involved in the temple service, nor are those disqualified because of blemishes or impurity, and it goes on. And he basically is going to take the place of the high priest as they go into the field of battle. You have an example of this back in the book of Judges, or 1 Samuel, excuse me, where the high priest Eli, his two sons, take the Ark of the Covenant out into battle with them. Now, we have several places in the Kings, in the Chronicles, that it talks about the priesthood going into battle. And these would be examples of what would happen there.
Joe?
Yes.
One of the people in the lady in the chat room asked me if the high priest, or pardon me, the priest that's leading us in time of war, was appointed for a specific war.
Yes.
Ah, okay. So it was a temporary position, and it ended when the war ended.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Very
There's no standing position of the priest anointed to lead in war.
Right. Okay. Amazing.
Good question. Very good question.
Yeah. Halakha 20.
Okay.
Are we ready for Halakha 20? Okay. When the king, the high priest, or any other official dies, his son or anyone fit to inherit him is appointed in his stead. Those who are higher in the order of inheritance receive precedence with regard to receiving the position of the deceased, provided he is equivalent to the deceased in wisdom or in the fear of God, even if he is not comparable in wisdom. For Deuteronomy 17:20 states with regard to a king, he and his descendants in the midst of Israel. This teaches that the kingship is inherited. This applies with regard to any office amidst the Jewish people. If one acquires it, he acquires it for himself and for his descendants.
Which is what we've already talked about, that with the Levi, that they were divided into different groups. Those that would be gatekeepers, those that would be singers, those that would be musicians. That it is a family responsibility. It is passed from father to son and to his son.
Right. And a couple of questions here. How do you figure out whether or not the descendant is equivalent to the deceased in wisdom?
Well,
is that maybe a decision made by a superior, made by one of the Kohanim, or maybe by a Levite who headed up whatever function it was of the person who died?
I'm going to guess it's done by the Sanhedrin.
Okay.
They're the ones that appoint the high priest.
Right. Yeah. So this is just another appointive thing here. Another way of a situation where a determination had to be made between two or more people, and the Sanhedrin would be the ones that make that distinction.
You know, when you have the United States government, when you have a cabinet member appointed, he has to go and be approved by the Senate.
Right.
They go in and they're going to grill him. They're going to try to turn over every leaf. They're going to see if this guy is really qualified.
In fact, witness that in the current Attorney General proceedings. That's what's happening right now. The replacement Attorney General is going through a very rough time because the Senate wants to make sure that they're not buying into a problem.
Okay, you ready for 21?
Yes. Yes, 21.
We're going to talk about our priest that's anointed to lead in war.
Okay, the position of being the priest anointed to lead the nation in war is not transferred to one son. Instead, the son is like all other priests. If he is anointed as the leader in war, he is anointed. If he is not anointed, he is not anointed. So that's just another way of saying that they're chosen, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. When the priest who was anointed to lead the nation in war serves in the temple, he serves wearing four garments like the other priests. Okay. A person should be promoted to a higher position than the one he holds and should not be demoted to a lower position. For one must ascend with regard to holy matters and not descend. A person should never be removed from a position of authority within the Jewish people unless he acts in an unsuitable manner.
All right, I want to read some of the notes that we have with this priest who's anointed to lead in war, because it's going to give a lot of definition here. It says the Rabbaz maintains that this ruling has to do with the unique function this priest serves. Since he leads the nation in war, it is a life or death question, and the most capable person is chosen whether he is the heir or not. Mm-hmm. In a response, Orach Chaim 12, the Hatam Sofer takes the opposite perspective, explaining the distinction between this and other positions which are inherited as follows. The kingship and other similar positions are appointments associated with leadership. Hence, if the heir is fundamentally capable, he inherits his father's position. The priest who leads the nation in war, by contrast, is an appointment based on holiness that is not transferred by inheritance. Indeed, the high priest would not be transferred by inheritance were there not a specific verse commanding us to do so. The halakha here is that there was no obligation either way. While he leads them in war, he wears the 8 garments of the high priest. However, when he comes back to the temple, he only wears the 4 white garments. He does not replace the high priest. He became the high priest in this event in the field, and only right. in the field.
For warfare, yes.
For warfare, okay. Yes.
Gotcha. Interesting. Interesting. Okay, one more halakha on this chapter. Halakha 22. When a high priest violates a transgression that is punishable by lashes, he should be given lashes and accorded 3 judges, as is the law regarding others liable for lashes. He then returns to his position of eminence.
All right. And again, this is an example of what we talked about before. It's because of the kedusha of the office. Let me read right. a note here. It says the Jerusalem Talmud, and this is in Sanhedrin 2:1, explains that this comes as a result of the holiness with which the high priest is endowed. It is a microcosm of God's holiness, and hence, like his holiness, it cannot be nullified. So basically, right. after he's been punished, everyone is to act as though everything is fine now.
Yeah, so once the punishment has been executed, he is then returned to where he was before. The presumption is not that there's any kind of residual punishment.
Right, he has the same honor, distinction that he had before.
Gotcha, okay. Okay, on to chapter 5?
On to chapter 5.
Okay, Halakha 1. The high priest must surpass all of his priestly brethren in beauty, power, wealth, wisdom, and appearance. If he does not have wealth of his own, all of his priestly brethren should give him according to their financial capacity until he is wealthier than all of them.
Okay, as to what this exactly meant, that the high priest must surpass all of his priestly brethren in beauty, power, wealth, wisdom, and appearance. Maimonides made a note about this, is that this was summed up in his fear of God. So, to me, I look at this and its approach from two perspectives. I'm trying to think of the best way to be able to communicate this. We think of somebody that has beauty. We're thinking more of the physical attractiveness.
Right.
How do you think when Hashem sees somebody that's beautiful, what do you think he's looking at?
Far more than that.
I think he's looking at the heart.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He's looking at the attitude. Yes. Power. What would power mean? From our perspective, that would be one that is able to control people. Has control over different items. From God's perspective, I would see that as power with Hashem.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The
yes.
Wealth, to me, would not be financial wealth. Wealth would be
right.
spiritual wealth. Godly wisdom. There is worldly wisdom and there is godly wisdom. and his overall appearance, his overall fear of God.
Right. In other words, those characteristics, as they would be considered from the standpoint of Hashem.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I believe that this was the downfall of many of the later high priests, is that they went after power, wealth, and so forth, at the expense of the sanctification of God.
In fact, that was a problem with King Saul, even as a king.
Yes,
he was chosen because he was taller and more good looking, and that didn't seem to stop him from having a very, very bad time as the king.
Let me ask you, Jade, in your opinion, what do you see as the first sin?
The first sin?
Yes.
Oh boy. Well, you know, obviously the sin. The first thing I see is Eve repeating the commandment of Yahweh in a different way to the serpent.
Okay. I would go back further than that.
Really?
Because
okay.
I believe that by the time that Eve or Hava, the whole episode that we have in chapter 3 of Bereishit of Genesis, that we already have that Nakash or the serpent had rebelled. And, I believe that his rebellion was pride.
Uh-huh.
He saw himself as equal to Hashem.
Yes, yes, okay. Mm-hmm.
And yep, so,
that makes sense.
I believe that pride, we're told about Leviathan, or the Leviathan, that he is the king over the children of pride. That is the enemy, the enemy's primary tool, is he can appeal to man's pride. And that's an area that we're very vulnerable in. And he uses it to his advantage frequently. And so I think of all the halakot, that this one, I think that you have to be most careful with, that it has to be the godliness of wisdom, wealth, power, and beauty. And otherwise, it's going to lead to downfall.
You know, this next halakha sort of clarifies that too, I think. Halakha 2 says, none of the above is an absolute requirement. Speaking of all, I think of that list of qualities.
It yes.
says, instead, all of this is merely the optimum way of fulfilling the mitzvah. If he was nonetheless initiated, his initiation is valid. And I'm going to add to that, despite how he may or may not have fit someone's conception of those qualities.
Yes.
So, yeah. That,
okay, Halakha 3?
Yes, Halakha 3. The high priest must conduct himself with dignity. He should not act frivolously with the people at large. They should not see him naked, nor in the bathhouse, nor in the toilet, nor while he is having his hair cut. As Leviticus 21:6 states, the priest greater than his brethren. This teaches that he is regarded with great honor. Nevertheless, if he desires that others bathe with him, he may allow them to do so.
Okay, we've already read Halakha 4, but right. Why don't we read over it very quickly?
Okay, Halakha 4. He should not enter a celebration or a public feast, even if they are associated with a mitzvah. If he desires, however, he may go to a house of mourning. If he goes, he does not go walking together with the other priests. Instead, the priests surround him and display honor to him, and the segan arranges the contact between him and the people. The segan and an anointed priest who is removed from his position stand at his right, and the head of the clan serving in the temple, the mourners and all others, are to his left. He tells the mourners, be comforted, and they honor him according to their capacity.
Okay, now one phrase we did not speak of when we talked about this halakha earlier, it says the segan, an anointed priest who is removed from his position. Gene, any idea what that would be?
Right.
An anointed priest who is removed from his position?
The only thing I can think of would be that he did something that required him to be removed or to be punished in some way, but I don't know. Is it just a standard? No, I can't imagine that it would just be for a, because of a physical deformity or something. So what was it?
Well, it's a priest that during the week of Yom Kippur, it is required that a Kohen Gadol go into the Holy of Holies and perform the entire service. So we read in Yom 1-1, which deals with Yom Kippur. 7 days before Yom Kippur, they separate the high priest from his house to the Palhedrin chamber.
Right.
And they prepare for him another priest in his stead in case a disqualification befalls him. So this is that priest who, in the case that the high priest became impure for one for Yom Kippur, he served as the high priest.
Right. So in other words, that way he would be ready and prepared and all ready to go just in case.
Yes, and that's what this halakha is in reference to.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Something else there that struck me. Let's see. One thing. This is another thing I want to point out to the people that are coming from the same background that I came from. You notice it says there, instead the priests surround him and display honor to him, and the Segan arranges the contact between him and the people. Notice that those other priests are not surrounding him because they're sucking up to him, so to speak. They're surrounding him because that is the requirement. That is what's expected of them.
Very good point.
I think people need to understand that this is not people, you know, looking for favor or anything. They're doing what they are commanded to do.
So, yes. It's very similar to in England, where, or throughout Europe, you had royalty, and they had these big palaces. They had these big houses. When a noted individual, a duke or a baron, would show up, the entire staff would be outside to meet them, and they are also in an order according to their position in that household.
Right.
And
you know, it's choreographed so well that it doesn't look like it's that formal. But really, the bottom line is it's all set up. All right. That's the end of these 2 hours. Thank you for joining us, everyone. We'll see you in another week on Sunday evening. Thank you, Joe. Shalom to everyone.